Perfect, we're all recording. Hi, Jill. Thank you for coming. It's fabulous to have you here. I wondered if you would start by introducing yourself a little bit to everyone.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I mean, you know, any opportunity to talk, particularly about investing and property and supported living, I'm right there first in the queue. So first of all, thank you for the opportunity. And then to give a bit of a background about me personally, for people that don't know me, I'm actually a rags to riches story. So I was born in the East End of London in a two up, two down. So we had, it's really funny, we had two living rooms, but we saved one for best. So there were five of us crammed into this little room, living room, 8 by 10, I guess. So I come from extreme poverty where, you know, we didn't have a bathroom. You know, I didn't have a bath until I was about 17, I don't think. But we didn't have a bathroom. The loo was outside and down the end of the garden. And compare that to the house I'm sitting here now, you know, I've got seven bathrooms, you know, one for every day of the week. And they're all indoors. That's the amazing thing. You know, when I was a child, toilets were outdoors. So I come from extreme poverty. And that's not only financial poverty, but emotional poverty as well. I was very unsupported as a child because I had a handicapped elder brother, which we can talk about later. So I come from extreme poverty, and gradually, through wanting to move away from that and being a bit of a contrary Mary, I've worked out how to make money and how to make myself financially free, and how to buy a magnificent mansion in the Sussex countryside. And I've done that organically and gently, and it hasn't felt risky, and it's felt like an organic, wonderful process. And I think I've discovered the formula to wealth, you know. And it's not that everybody has to be extremely wealthy, because a lot of people don't want that, you know, as long as they've got enough to feed the kids and the dog, that's all they need. But I know how to make people feel safe with their money, and how to relax and drop the shoulders and think, I haven't got to worry about where the next month's rent's coming from. And it's a simple five-step formula, which we can or needn't talk about. And that's all I've done. And I now have a company called Fielding Financial, where we teach people those principles, and very specifically, which is where I met you, specifically talking about how to invest in property wisely and appropriately. But we also teach people how to trade shares, do other things as well. But property is my first love. I started investing in property when I was 19. So I was very quick out of the gutter, because I was very motivated to get out of the gutter. And I invested in my first, effectively, buy-to-let when I was 19. And that was before buy-to-lets were invented, because I'm old. So that's the brief history of Virgil Fielding.
That's amazing. And when you, with Fielding Financial, you know, I mean, your story is such an inspirational story, and the way you're so sort of modest about it and honest about it, I think, as well, I think is what's really refreshing, because so many people are so kind of bragging about wealth, aren't they, and that wealth needs to be a sports car or, you know, and actually, as you say, it's having that security and feeling relaxed around money, isn't it, you know. But when you set up Fielding, you had quite a big kind of goal around property, didn't you, and around actually sort of helping people as well as part of it, and that's something.
Yeah, yes, I mean, I have a life mission. You know, I'm not necessarily a religious person, but I look into my soul from time to time. And I honestly believe that I was put on this planet to light the spark of financial possibility for as many people as I can get to. And that's about the choice. It's about giving people the information so that they can make the choice as to whether they become financially free or wealthy, or they can just cover their expenses, or whatever it means to them. Because I think we are so badly educated in this country about money. So we have, first of all, we have a very bad education system, and nobody teaches these basics to kids. And they come out of school at 18, they get one credit card because it looks exciting, and that's enough to keep them in debt for at least 25 years. And then they're close to retirement. And then, you know, and that frightens me. I want people to be aware that there is a different way. And as you rightly say, I'm not into flashy luxury. I don't have a flashy car and never have had. For me, it's about everybody having the ability to have their definition of enough. Now, enough varies from person to person, and there'll be people that won't feel they've got enough with 5 million and people that will feel they've got plenty more than enough on 5,000. So it's a, you know, a personal measure. I also think that there's a stigma, it's certainly in the Western world, about people who have money. You know, it's often misquoted that money's the root of all evil. And that's not the quote. The quote is, the love of money is the root of all evil. And it's that obsessive love of something that is evil. And that would be true of money and lots of other things, actually. Mm-hmm. It's not just money, because what I realised early on from my people watching and from when I was in the gutter and growing up was that there were certain people that seemed to achieve more in life and seemed to be more settled and more contented and satisfied with their life, whatever they were doing. And when I looked deeply, and I've always been a people watcher, when I looked deeply into what differentiated those people, there were two main factors. One, they had taken responsibility for their life and they weren't just carried along in the tide of humanity. So they'd taken humanity and taken stock. And secondly, they'd all got their money sorted. And that's where the money thing started to blossom. And I realized if we can just get the money thing sorted so that we've got enough to pay the bills and feed the dog, then we start concentrating on the parts of life that are far more important, like love and caring and sharing, community and health and, you know, all those magnificent things that we could be spending our time doing. So it was that realization that once you've got the money thing sorted, then you're free. then you're away. You know, but unfortunately, most people spend their entire life not getting the money thing sorted, and then they die.
Absolutely. Heartbreaking. And as part of Fielding, you've set up Money Mum, haven't you, as well?
Money Mum is our charity, and that's about educating people as best we can. And it uses the five principles of wealth creation, which very quickly are knowing what comes in and goes out, knowing how to make your money stretch till the next payday, benefits day, whatever it might be, understanding, managing and controlling debt, understanding that there is a future value of money, and if you get your money invested, it's worth a lot more in the future than it is today, because a lot of people don't get that one. And the fifth principle is about understanding that if it's to be, it's up to me, it's my responsibility. And we want to get those five principles into schools, into young people. We work with like young offenders. We've done quite a lot of work with prisons, people coming out of prison. They have no financial knowledge. We've worked with the Salvation Army. We have a plan to work with young people who are being released from care. So people that are in young people's care homes, foster homes, that kind of thing. Again, they leave at the age of 18, and they've had this life where everything has been sorted for them, and they leave and they've got no skills, they've got no financial skills. And with the young offenders type thing, I think we can push them out of some kind of care, whether it be prison or whatever it might be, and not give them the skills, because otherwise they just revert to the behaviour they had before, because they've got no other way. They don't know how else to do it. And if only we could educate these people that there is another way, then, you know, I think we'd have less people in prisons, we'd have less people in care, we'd have less people with mental health issues. You know, the impacts on society as a whole would be massive, would be absolutely massive. And it's perfectly doable. So Money Mum is the charity with the aim, let's get these principles out into as many people as we can and support them and educate them on those five principles. And then we might make a difference.
Amazing. Now, you said a little bit at the beginning about your brother and the experience of growing up with a disabled brother. Do you want to talk a little bit more about him?
He's absolutely adorable. He's nearly 70. When he was born, my parents were told that he would certainly never live to adulthood because he was starved of oxygen at birth. So he's completely and utterly mentally disabled and needs 24-hour care, has a mental age of a baby, basically. He was sectioned and taken into care when he was about 10. But he was placed in an institution, and it was a real old-fashioned, grim, Victorian bars-on-the-windows type thing, which wasn't appropriate for him, but that was the way care was. He was born in the early 1950s.
So he was 10, and he was taken away.
And then I mean, obviously, I've adored him all my life. You know, when I was born, he was there. So I've never known any different. That's what brothers look like, as far as I was concerned. And I've adored him and loved him all my life. He's been my playmate. And, you know, we've got our own secret communication methodologies. And, you know, we understand each other. And then when I got older and grown up, and I started to be a bit more savvy about things like supported living. I mean, supported living didn't exist when he was born. Yeah. But in the, I think it must have been the late 80s, early 90s, you might know this better than me, there was an Act of Parliament passed about community living and about getting these people back into community type of environments. And that was revolutionary. I remember talking to Lord Brian Ricks, who you may or may not remember, but he's passed now, but he was life president of MenCap, and he initiated loads of legislation for people like my brother Raymond and similar people. And I met with him, and he said, you've got to get your brother into community type of care. So I thought, all of the authorities and got him into what was community care at the time. But again, it looks quite a lot like an institution. It was a big house and there were lots of them in there. And although care was better and there weren't bars on the window, it still wasn't good enough. No. But of course, it was the best we had. Mm. And then in the middle 1990s, supported living started for me and my family. And I managed to get Raymond into what I call a supported living environment, which is he lives in a bungalow with five other people that are similar to him. And he lives there very happily and has lived there for 20 odd years. And he has his own bedroom and we decorate it. And, you know, I buy the furniture and, you know, we've got pictures on the walls and all the rest of it. And what the people who care for them have done is they support him to live as close to a life of choice as a person in his circumstances possibly can. Brilliant. And they support him to make choices with food, for example, and they support him to make choices with what he's wearing. They support him to make choices with entertainment. And you know, they can show him two things and he can pick one or the other. So for me, he's being supported in a totally caring way, and as that journey has progressed, he's got better and better. Going from somebody who was totally uncommunicative and verbally he can't speak or anything like that, I have weekly WhatsApp calls with him. You know, and I sit on the screen like this and he sits on the other end laughing because I'm on the telly.
Oh.
You know, funny. But you know,
I think for people who haven't, you know, for people who've only ever really known a supported living setup when they're thinking about people with learning disabilities, if they hadn't experienced that, where Raymond's been on his journey to get to where he is now, they would think that that's not revolutionary that he's involved in his food choices. But actually, that is quite revolutionary compared to the places that he's lived, isn't it? That actually he didn't have any choice, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. It's totally revolutionised his life. It's changed his life. And I can honestly say, hand on heart, he lives a lovely life, a wonderful life. He laughs a lot, you know, obviously not during lockdown, but he gets taken out and, they go on holiday. And I mean, obviously the house is prepared for supported living, you know, very wide corridors, obviously wet rooms, et cetera, et cetera. There's a light room, et cetera. But he's got his own bedroom. And when I go there, he goes straight to the kitchen area because he knows I'm going to get a cup of tea. So he's learned from somebody who was nowhere and with nothing, through this supported living environment, he's learned social skills.
Amazing.
And Jill's here, we're going to have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. And it's been wonderful to see the change in him and how much calmer and settled and contented he's become, and happy, and how happy he's become. Mm. Wonderful.
That's amazing. And I think hearing those powerful stories, you know, it just illustrates the importance of good supported living setups, doesn't it? And I think obviously we're looking at this from a property perspective in this podcast, but you know, I think people understanding those stories and the direct impact it has on people's lives and can be completely transformative. But I think looking at it from the other perspective, when you're looking at it as a property investor, it can be a really powerful property investing strategy too. And I think it's combining those two that is the real power in supported living, isn't it? I think
without a doubt. I mean, one of my missions, we have a very large student body, all of whom have learned property investing skills, learning how to invest for income, how to invest for growth and whatever. And I wish I could put a term in our contract which says, and when you bought one for yourself, you've got to buy one for somebody else. Because I passionately believe that as long as the investment works and the system works, and I mean by that, you know, does it pay its way? Are you going to make some profit, some cash flow? Are you going to make some return from this in the end? Once you cover that broad principle, it doesn't really matter whether your tenant is somebody who's an ex-abuser, somebody who's got learning difficulties, a battered family member. I'm going to say battered woman, but it could easily be a man too. Mm-hmm. And we're forever promoting those kind of schemes to our student body, because if we can support those kind of people, I mean, how wonderful is that? Mm. It makes a fantastic investment, and actually it's a better investment than some others, because more or less, if it's rent, for example, the rent is more or less guaranteed because it's paid by an authority or a body or something like that. So first of all, you've not got to keep chasing them for rent in the same way. The rent's not going to stop if they get furloughed.
No.
That's not how it works. So your sales income, your cash flow, your rent is more or less guaranteed. And the other thing that I find really positive about it is that because these people are supported, the properties get looked after better. Yeah. Because they're being mentored to live in that environment. So the properties don't get trashed, et cetera, et cetera, because these people are being supported. Mm. So actually, it's a far better investment than some straightforward buy-to-let investments. And if I could have a rule in our company that says everybody's got to provide housing for a disadvantaged person, let's say, of some kind, or else I'm going to come and sleep at night, then I would. But obviously, people have to have choice. But I would love that. We've got somebody in the Midlands that is in her local town. Excuse me. She's taken the task of housing all the homeless in her town, and she knows exactly how many there are. And that's her objective, and she's going to do it. We've got another group that provide housing for battered wives, basically. And I know we have a growing group now of people that are providing housing for supported living, which is a real, real bonus for me personally.
It's just fabulous. I love the ethos, you know, behind the whole thing. And like you say, I think a lot of property investors have a bad name, don't they? People, like you were saying about people assuming there being a bad reputation around money and people with money. I think the same with property investors, that they're all money grabbing, evil landlords. And actually, what I've found since I've been talking more and more about supported living is how many property owners and landlords are really passionate about doing something different with their portfolios, aren't they? You know, they love the idea of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I hate the idea of the wicked landlord. And of course, I've been a landlady since 1977. And I've always treated my tenants with just respect. I had a tenant in there in one of my properties for over 30 years. Now, that doesn't happen unless you're good to the tenant. And as far as I'm concerned, I treat my tenants like I would want to be treated if I was in a rental accommodation. And I know them, and I know when they have babies, and, you know, I really care about them. And if I can help them, if I can help them, say, for example, if they want to move on, if I can help them find another property, either within my own portfolio or somewhere else, I will do. I've had two instances where I've actually sold the property to the tenants because they liked living there, and we found a way to enable them to buy it. So I do actually think the vast majority of landlords are compassionate, kind, honest people who are providing their own financial security and providing decent accommodation for others. As in every walk of life, there are a handful, small numbers of people that don't care, don't get licensed, don't do all the stuff they should do. And unfortunately, they're the people that tend to get reported on in the media.
Yeah, they're the ones who people hear about, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, people don't want me sitting on the telly going, well, I like my tenant and he bought me biscuits last week.
No heat, is it? No. Yeah. Now, Jill, I know that you've also, obviously, with all the stuff that you do, you've got a really good weather eye on what's happening with the property market at the moment and where we are with things. And I think it's not been what people have predicted, I think, with the pandemic, has it, with property prices? Do you want to talk a little around
that? No, I'd love to talk about that, and in fact it is what I predicted.
Oh, is it? Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely, because there are five drivers to the property market in this country particularly, and that's things like, you know, credit and interest rates and so on. But the overriding issue that keeps property prices supported in this country is supply and demand. And that's been true for centuries. We have property price records going back to the Doomsday Book in the UK. We're incredibly lucky. And you can see the gradual increase in prices over time. And it's always driven by demand and supply. And strangely enough, we have not built on much of the UK. We've only built on, less than 10% of the UK. So it's not that we don't have the land. We do. And what we also have is millions of people wanting their own home. And that's true of people that need supported living. And I'm sure that that's another reason why supported living is such a strong investment strategy. It's because there's such a high demand for it. Yeah. Can you imagine any other business where you had a ready-made demand, knowing, that you were going to get a customer? You know, if you were a plumber or a bookshop, you wouldn't know. But with property, you do know, because you know exactly how many people are on the local housing authority waiting lists. And that is estimated at perhaps 2 million or more across the country. We know that how many people are looking for properties. And for example, Rightmove recorded its ever highest property search in January this year, 2021. So we know that there is a high demand. Meanwhile, supply is very low. Each successive government since I've been looking at property, so from like the early 80s, has said, we need to build, and we're going to build. We're going to build 250,000, 300,000 houses a year for the next 20 years. None of them ever do. None of them. Labour, Tory, Lib Dem, whatever. None of them ever do. And this current government has come out and said exactly the same. We need 300,000 houses a year. It isn't going to happen. We have a tradition of building about 100,000 new properties a year. So the supply is always lagging way behind demand.
And when I'm going to stop. Sorry, I'm going to stop you just because the my Wi-Fi went really weird. Can you hear me? All right.
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
I'm back again. I'm really sorry.
Where do you want me to start from?
Just, it was only just that last bit. So you got to where you said really high. You were talking about, sorry, that's really annoying, isn't it? Because you're on a really good bit. You were saying.
I mean, I'll just jump in and just say, okay. And even this government has said we need to build 300,000 houses a year. And it's never going to happen. We build about 100,000 properties a year and always have done. Since just after the Second World War, we had a peak. But since then, it's been about the same. Because councils don't have the money to build. Housing associations don't have the money to build. Governments don't have the money to build. So for as long as demand outstrips supply, property prices are always going to be supported and rising. Now, there will always be peaks and troughs in there. Of course, there will be, because people want to move at different times of the year. So they tend to want to move in the spring, and that tends to lift the property market a little. And then they don't want to move when the leaves fall off the trees. So it tends to lead to a slight dip. Apart from during the pandemic. Now, the pandemic changed everything. And in 2020, there was a little bit of a drop in March when we first went into lockdown. But as soon as everybody sort of righted themselves a little bit, about 6 weeks later, the property market started up again and kept going throughout the whole of the 2020. And we've just recorded the highest ever property price, the highest number of transactions, the most buoyant property market we've had probably for a decade. Mm. And specifically, demand continued. And you can see why. I mean, you know, not talking about my own family here, but if you're shut in with your mum and dad over Christmas, then come January, you want to find your own place. Now, just imagine being shut in with your mum and dad for 9 months. I mean, jeepers, you'd be desperate to get out. So there's a massive boost in demand from people who want to find their own place. And there's also been a change in demand in that people want to go further out. So property searches now go beyond 40 miles, which they didn't before. So people want to go further out because they want more space. They know they're not going to be going into the office every day. So actually, if you looked at the underlying criteria for the property market, even in the pandemic, you could see it was going to be all right. And that is why property investing and this five principle knowledge is so important, because once you know all those things, you don't need to worry. I don't need to worry about what Rishi Sunak is going to say in the budget in March, if he's going to say anything, for heavens. I mean, what can the poor man say? So good luck with that one, Rishi, when you get there. You don't have to worry about that, because that doesn't impact me. And that's what property investing does. It makes you immune to the government, to the pandemic, to the economy. It doesn't matter what happens with the normal economy, because my personal economy is safe. And it gives you a sense of security and immunity, which is incredibly protective. And, you know, going through a pandemic in those circumstances, you know, the properties have saved me. They've saved all our students, because the rents kept coming. And my properties have saved me many times in my life when I've had challenges. You know, we all have challenges. I've talked about my brother. There's been some difficult times there. Properties always saved me and gave me the chance to not worry about money for 6 months while I went off and sorted my brother out. Sadly, I lost my husband to cancer, and the time from which he was diagnosed to when he passed away was only just over 6 months. And from the second he was diagnosed, I didn't do anything other than be with him, because that was what was important to do. Mm. And the property saved me. And it's when you've taken responsibility for your money and you understand the principles and you get it sorted, then that reaps benefits, and that will come back and support you, and, you know, the properties will support you And that's what makes it all so powerful. So as much as I like Rishi Sunak, he looks like a nice guy, doesn't he? I mean, his tie's always straight. I mean, what else can I say? But what he does say is irrelevant to me and my personal economy. I'm not worried about the macro economy. All I'm worried about is my micro economy, and that's safe.
Jill, thank you. That's been brilliant. Thanks ever so much for that. And if people want to contact you, we'll put your contact details in the show notes so people can get hold of you there. So thanks ever so much.
You're welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure. Can we talk for another 3 hours?
Yeah, let's.
Thanks very much, Lisa.
I'll stop recording. Brilliant.